Lutimo Gossin, Lutakin Joe, Lutimo Gossin, Lutakin, Tiki Tiki.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and we just had the lovely theme by George Cooper. And you've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Today on the program, we're going to have Jessica Abel here joining us via phone. Nice sound effect with like the dial tone, but or the busy signal, right? But we'll be reconnecting shortly. And until we do, I'm going to read the short bio on the back of Jessica's book, out May 2017, Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. This is Jessica's latest. We also have on the table, Out on the Wire, the Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. We've got her graphic novel, La Perdida, her book, Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, co-written with her husband, Matt Madden. And also, I was lucky enough to find Mirror Window, which is a compilation of Jessica Abel's Art Babe, some of her comics. So, the bio. Author Jessica Abel is a 25-year-old vet of the creative focus wars, having published 6 books of comics, including Out on the Wire and La Perdida, 2 textbooks about making comics, and a podcast series, all while being married, having 2 children, living in 5 cities in 3 countries, teaching comics and illustrations for many years, founding the Creative Focus Workshop, and now heading up the illustration program at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us via phone today.
Well, thanks for having me. And I should clarify, I'm not a 25-year-old vet. I'm a 25-year vet.
Yes.
I didn't do all of that in my first 25 years of life, that's for sure.
Well, at any rate, still pretty amazing. Yeah. And of course, vet being for like the veteran of like creative focused wars. So you just seem like just the right person to have created this book, Growing Gills. I've really been enjoying it, Jessica.
Oh, I'm glad.
And thanks for agreeing to talk via phone. You are right now, you're talking to us from Philadelphia.
Yeah, from Philadelphia, exactly.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks again for being here. Let's start with Growing Gills, because we were talking about all the books that we do have here to talk about with you. But Growing Gills is the latest endeavor. What was the genesis of this? How did you decide to take the Creative Focus Workshop and put it into book form?
I mean, I'm a writer, so it seemed like the most obvious thing to do to me was to make a book out of what I was doing. You know, like writing my blog about these issues, about the issues of trying to get your creative work done despite living in the total chaos of everyday life. Seems like, you know, at first I'm writing these things very just kind of piecemeal, but very quickly I started writing series. I was writing posts that would be like a series of four or whatever. I'd be coming back to themes that I had written about, you know, a few months earlier and kind of looking at them from a different direction. And, you know, really, if I think I've never treated a blog as kind of an update on my life kind of thing. You know, that's just not what I do. I really write much more sort of first draft chapters. And between that and creating a lot of training, pedagogical material, you know, worksheets, all this stuff, I thought this is, you know, it didn't take me long to pull it together, really, you know, given that I'd already done so much. So much writing on the topic and so much work on it. It was one of the fastest turnaround book projects I've done.
And Jessica, you made the decision to go through Amazon publishing, like almost going back, because you began self-publishing when you were photocopying your first comics and hand sewing the binding, making the covers with rubber stamps or potato potatoes. So what was some of the decisions that drove choosing to self-publish Growing Gills?
Well, I mean, I've worked with lots of mainstream publishers. You know, I have a couple books that are under the Random House, Penguin Random House, you know, umbrella in different imprints. I have books with Macmillan and, you know, Houghton Mifflin and, you know, a lot of the big guys. And
yeah, and starting with Fantagraphics, too, way back.
Yeah, I'm starting with Fantagraphics, right. So less big, but, you know, legit publisher.
Completely, yeah.
And I have gotten a lot of value out of working that way. You know, certainly visibility comes from that. I've worked with some, you know, some really great editors who've helped, you know, like for Out on the Wire in particular, working with Megan Stacey Levinson. She was just an amazing editor who totally helped me think through all the really difficult problems about how to put that work together. So, you know, this no shade on publishers and editors,
right.
But it is a very lengthy process. And once you go through that process, you lose a ton of control in terms of what you can do with the book, where you can show it, who can you give it away to, you know, how can you utilize that book various different ways to support your career, you know, there are a lot of limitations on it. And so I just thought I would experiment with being an independent publisher, you know, just independent writer and make a self-published book. And, you know, it's so easy these days to do it. It's just, like, incredibly easy. I mean, yeah, it took a day or so of wrestling with the Amazon interface, trying to get the PDF, you know, formatted exactly how they wanted it to get it to work. But it's incredibly easy. And, I mean, I have students, undergrad students, who are publishing on Amazon, and they're just like, oh, my God, I'm a published author. How does that happen? You know, it's this kind of amazing thing, you know. But... you know, I was able to, I did a whole bunch of giveaways. Like, you know, initially when the book came out, I gave it away for free for 4 or 5 days. And that was easy for me to do, to make that decision to do that. And it's really spread the word about the work that I'm doing. And, you know, I've gained a lot of subscribers on my email list, people who've joined, you know, my coaching programs and things as a result of it. So there's, you know, a sort of business aspect to why you would do that. But then creatively, it's like, I can do this. I can revise it, put a new one up. I can do whatever I want. And I can write my own book copy and, you know, do all the kind of targeting that I want to do. So that's been really interesting and fun. And I don't know that I'm like 100% going to do independent publishing from now on.
Right.
But it's certainly an option that I consider, you know, especially for prose, because I've been a cartoonist most of the time. Like I have other prose books, but most of my books are comics, and e-books of comics are less than ideal. Let's put it that way. Like, you know, they're okay, but printed books are just still so much better when it comes to comics. But for prose books, you know, there are a lot of arguments for both ways of going. And so this was one of my first fully prose books. And I was like, oh, well, this is an opportunity.
And it actually feels like Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. This book of all of them so far, it makes sense to make it this way in some way, because in a way it's like you're showing what some of the book is even trying to talk about is, and it's sort of an inspiration even like with and,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as I was doing it, as I was creating the book and then creating, you know, doing the publishing piece of it and the marketing for it, I posted a blog entry. I was sending out emails to people. I called it the Full Monty, where I talked about everything that was going on behind the scenes and posted those on my blog. They're down now because it's not, you know, I would need to re-edit it into something. But that was, you know, that was the thing. It's like I'm walking the walk. That's what it's all about.
Exactly. And showing that it can be done. And I wonder if, do you think also it was maybe easier to make this decision? And because you already, like you mentioned earlier, you do have a network, and you also have, you've published with Penguin Random House, Pantheon Books, Fantagraphics, like, you know, like there's, and two textbooks as well, for comics. Like, do you feel like it might have made it also easier then to think, yeah, I'm going to be an independent publisher. I'm going to self-publish.
Because I had that platform, you mean?
Well, and because you've already published in other venues as well. So it's not as if you felt like you needed that for validation in some ways.
Right. Yeah. No, I didn't. It definitely was freeing for me, and feeling like I didn't need to I didn't feel like the validation of having a mainstream publisher really is all it's cracked up to be. You know, having had it, I feel like, okay, that's good, but there's other ways to go about this. I mean, I guess the one piece of it that it would have been nice to have a little bit more validation for it is, it's a self-help book, basically. You know, it's a book that helps people who are struggling to make their creative work, make time for it, make space for it in their lives. How do you do that? And it's a very hands-on book, full of activities, full of, you know, there's a workbook you can download to go with it. And if you don't do the workbook, nothing will happen. Like, if you don't actually do the activities, right, you can read about this all you want, but nothing will change.
Well, you pretty much say that on page 2, I think, Jessica.
I do. I say it over and over again, but it doesn't always sink in. But anyway, the point is, it's a hands-on activity book. You know, it's very different from what I've done before. And so in that sense, I think there's an element of sort of, I wish that I had, you know, more institutional backing for it, because I feel like this material is something that, man, every person I meet needs, you know?
Right.
And I do wish it was getting out to a much larger audience. I mean, it's doing fine, you know, considering it's a self-published book that I do zero marketing for.
Right.
It's fine, you know, it sells and people are coming to me for it, but it's like, you know, I feel like this book of all of my books is like, the audience for it is potentially enormous.
Well, if anyone finds your website, which many of people will be coming to it, it feels like they can get the book, order the book there. You can also go to Amazon and it can be, if you've got Prime, it can arrive in 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And if you buy the ebook, you can get it instantaneously.
Exactly. Although, like you were saying earlier, maybe it's just a product of my time or like whatever, an old one. But there's something about also having this book in your hand so that you can mark it up even before you start doing the activities. Because my experience with it so far is I had to keep moving through it. This is not just another excuse, Jessica. I feel like your voice gets in one's head when you start reading Growing Gills. So nice work.
People have said that.
Nice work.
You know, WWJAD, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back to talk more today on the program with Jessica Abel, who joins us from Philadelphia via phone. The book that we're talking about now, Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. Get your copy now. Go to Amazon. You can find it there. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass and Gina, too. We'll be right back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today on the program, Jessica Abel is here. Her book, Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. And you can find it, go to Amazon and order your copy. You can also go to Jessica Abel's website and you'll find the workbook material there, right, Jessica, too?
Well, the link to the workbook is in the book, so... You know.
Oh, so that's right. I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Okay. I still
only for readers.
I know I've been caught out. See, I haven't downloaded the workbook yet, but I will. I will be doing it.
Okay.
Okay. So before the break, we were talking about like how your voice is really clear in this book, and other people besides myself has told you that your voice gets in their heads. So do you mind reading a section so we can kind of transfer that to all listeners right now?
Sure.
Okay.
And I think part of this too is like, I actually, after I created my book Out on the Wire, Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio, which is about the great storytellers of, you know, podcasting and radio, I created my own podcast, and so then I got really used to kind of reading and presenting in this. You know what I mean? Like, I think I have, like, it's both that I say things that stick with you, but in this particular book, because I, you know, I've been paying attention to how people talk about these issues, but also because, like, I think of it like that. You know, I think of it like narrative.
Really? So,
audio.
So you think that your work with audio and your work, you know, even analyzing as well as interviewing the folks on public radio for Out on the Wire, that changed your voice on the page?
I think so. I mean, I think so. Because, you know, also for my course, I record all of the materials. You know, there's an audio version and a, you know, transcript. And it's not just me talking, it's scripted. You know, so it's, oh. I've tried to, over time, get my written voice to reflect my spoken voice really closely.
Because
I use a lot of recording. Like, I record stuff all the time, and I transcribe it, and then I use that for material.
And so, and are you doing that as part of the process because you do believe in like trying to find like that natural, like that quality of speaking? So then you're generating it that way, then transcribing?
Yes. And I think that in conversation in particular, the ideas that we generate and the connections that we make are extremely different from what you get, and often higher quality than what you get when you're sitting by yourself. You know, I'm all for crafting prose when you're really trying to think of like the perfect word or turn of phrase or whatever to describe a thing that's, you know, that only you know or whatever it is, right?
Right.
But I actually think that certainly structurally speaking, working things out verbally is an incredibly powerful tool and very, very undervalued by writers. You know, everybody wants to go off in their cave and do it by themselves. But I think having an element of collaboration in your process is immensely valuable.
Oh, I completely agree. I completely agree. And it's so interesting to see how, like, through the years, and then this particular project of yours out on the wire, the Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio. Because I wanted to ask you about that later, like what, because it like the learning curve of that too, because it seemed to me that you're interviewing some, like for your project, and also listening closely and observing, witnessing, but you're interviewing people who are interviewing, you know, as their job all the time.
Mm-hmm. That was a little intimidating.
How so?
Can you imagine?
Yes. Yes. I just wondered if you wanted to share some of, how did you prepare for that?
I mean, as best I could, like I just, you know, I mean, it was a little catch as catch can there for a while, you know? I know to follow my curiosity. Like, I've never been somebody who over-prepared for an interview, you know, has, like, all the questions nailed down and wants to stick to the list. Like, I'm interested in what people are interested in, and I want to follow that. So I would try to prepare and make sure that I was covering the things that I thought I would need, but then allow for a lot of room there. And, you know, like, my interviews with Robert Smith, for example, at Planet Money, he's amazing. The guy's amazing. And and Ira too, talking to Ira Glass about it, their preparation techniques and interview techniques, the way that they'll sort of imagine how the writing is going to get structured, you know, how is the piece going to get put together, and then work their way backward to what are the questions they need to ask in order to get the material they're going to need in order to create the thing they need to create. I didn't do that. Like, I didn't know how to do that. And I wasn't doing that. And there's plenty of places where there are big gaps. But fortunately, I wasn't actually making audio so that I could just write it down. You know, I could just ask them later in email, or I could fill it in. I could have me say it, or, you know, there are lots of other ways to fill that gap when I realized, oh, I don't have what I need. But, and of course, since they're working in audio, they're like, if you don't get the tape, you don't have the tape.
Right, right. And I guess you could always do some sort of voiceover, but you can't have a whole thing full of connective tissue of your guiding narrative.
Right. Well, piece. And if you're working on deadline, you know, and trying to work fast, it's like, if you don't have this, you know, you just,
you don't have it.
Yeah. You don't have it. And, you know, also if you have, and I know you must know how this is, you like have 3 hours of interview tape and what you really need is 15 minutes, you know, or you need 3 minutes out of it. That's super daunting, where if you know what you want to ask, you can get 15 minutes and have to cut it down to 3. And that's what those guys can do. I had the 3 hours of tape. I had the 70 hours of tape, you know, like just talking about stuff and then figuring out what I needed out of it.
Well, if you, but if you do, so when you do have all that tape, how do you find the part where it feels like, this is the essence? Or how did you find yourself making those decisions? Like, this is the part that's the story. Like, this is the real story.
Oh my God. It was so painful.
Yeah.
It's not an easy process. Like, what is the story? You know, when you're telling a story about how do people make stories? How do you structure that? Was it just an immense problem for me? And for a really long time, I was trying to figure out, like, I thought about having it sort of, like, the original book that I created with Ira Glass back in 99, Radio and Illustrated Guide, which walks through the phases of making a show for them back then, which is pretty much the same way they do it now, just with different tech. You know, from pitch to interviewing to logging to, you know, all the different phases. And so we followed a show through. That was the narrative spine. You know, one show beginning to end.
So that makes sense. Yeah.
That makes sense. But then I tried to do that. I thought about doing that for Out on the Wire. But it's just too shaggy. Like, there's just too much different stuff. And right. I felt like the weight on this one show would be just too intense. And also kind of beside the point, you know, what the behind-the-scenes drama is sort of, it's just gossipy. You know, it's not what the book's really about. And so I went through many different iterations. At one point, I had rough logs of all my tape and notes on stuff, and I had 200,000 words just in a file of, like, stuff. And gradually, basically, I honed in on, here are the main topics I want to cover, you know, character and voice and story structure and sound and, you know, different that later became the chapters, although I didn't know initially how many chapters I would have and how that would break down. And then I could break up. I was using Scrivener, this app that uses a kind of folder structure or whatever, and I would break down my transcripts and say, okay, well, this relates to that, this relates to that, this relates to that, and kind of make these giant folders full of snippets. And then sort through those for the good stuff and then write connective tissue to kind of pull those things together. And that's kind of my methodology at this point with this nonfiction stuff. That's super simplifying. Like, there were a lot of times where two-thirds of the way through the process, I would find myself re-listening to some tape that I'd not logged yet. Or, you know, logging it took forever. And listening to something and thinking, like, oh, that answered a question I had 6 months ago. That would have been nice if I actually had that.
Right. And try, yeah, exactly. And so it sounds like what you're doing with this then is that you, God, that's an amazing amount of patience too, to go through and like when you were saying, putting these pieces into the giant folders in the Scrivener. Cause I'm wondering, it's like, I wonder the things that you've like, so you started to find these themes emerging, or like, oh, I definitely want to do something about character, or, but was it also something about the, something that you heard in the voice of the people when they were speaking? Like, was there something where, like, there's a different kind of energy sometimes and you think, oh, this is it. Or like, even in the moment when you're there with them recording it, you can kind of feel like, oh, these are some moments, or it's starting now, or this is something, even though I don't know what it is yet.
Yes, and doesn't work the same way in prose as it does on the radio, right? So one of the tricks to being a good interviewer, which I learned too late, but, you know, implemented part of the time, was when you finish your interview, when it's still super warm, you take notes either verbally or on paper of, like, what were the parts that you, you know, remember this part, these stuck out to me.
Right.
So that later you kind of can go back and find that stuff a little bit more easily. So that's important. But when you are, so turns of phrase, so you can do a lot more with prose than you can with a piece of tape. Like, you can slice and dice tape a lot, but there's a limit. Mm. You know, if somebody says something super awesome, but in a tone of voice that's not useful.
Yeah, what can you do?
You can't do anything about it. You know, if they say something like, you know, this earth-shattering revelation, but they say it in a way that's like, you know, falling into intonation, you can barely hear them, and it sounds really boring. You know, I can create a comics panel that puts that in focus in a way that audio can't do.
Right, and it's not as if, because even in the moment then, sometimes you might be able to ask them like another way into the question and try to get them to say something like it again. But if you don't know to do that, you don't have that moment.
Right, or they say it again, but it isn't as good, or, you know, you can't recapture that thing, you know. It's, and sometimes people will use tape that I wouldn't use, you know, the because of the way it's said, the emotion that's in it, it works as tape, but when you write it out, it doesn't work. So it works both ways.
I see. And with the drawing, though, because you did say there's ways that you can make it something else and in the drawing of it.
Right. So the words themselves, and so if you're writing prose, people can say stuff, again, they can say it in a way that's not useful as tape, but it works really well in prose. So that's good. But I have the additional advantage as a cartoonist of being able to draw it somehow in some particular kind of way. You know, I can make it an entire page. I can make the text really large. I could, you know, highlight it in various different, you know, there's 100 different ways you could highlight a moment and get people to pay attention to that. And for me, like, there's one of the most interesting things about creating a book like Out on the Wire is that it's a book about audio that's in prose, you know, and comics.
Right.
So that it's, you know, already we're like in a whole other zone. But there's so many ways that you can actually use images to create metaphors for nonverbal things. So music, sound, but also concepts. So, you know, I have this whole tool bag of stuff that I could create visual metaphors with that help people, help readers understand the context of what's going on or the content.
And these become layers within the panels, within the pages themselves. And some, like if a reader, it might be happening on a subconscious level for the readers of Out on the Wire, but they also, if they're deconstructing it as close readers, they'll start to see these layers.
Yeah, and there's a lot of complexity in the way that I presented the information in general, where there's a, what in radio speak you call actuality level, where it's like they're quotes from people and they're in real space and they're drawn in one style. And then there's this other layer, which I call the meta layer, where everybody's drawn differently. They're drawn in a very clean line, simple black and white style, no backgrounds. And that's when they're talking, that's sort of the narration level and the analysis level. And I can speak to other producers. I can speak to Ira. We can talk about what's happening in the actualities, the quotes, and get, you know, I can use this complex system of layers, as you say, to clearly convey the difference between one kind of text and another kind of text, which in prose you can't do. Like, it's very hard to do that.
Right. So, for example, in Out on the Wire, you could have the characters of you and Ira Glass walk through this book, and then you could even have the background panels or scenes be maybe Planet Money at work in the studio or in the field collecting an interview. Or so that's what you're talking about a little bit.
Right. So there's something going on. You know, some of the quotes are from my interviews, so it's me talking to a producer. But then that same producer can come in at the meta level and point to that interview and say, this is the moment when I realized X. And here's what X means. You know, or I can say that.
Exactly. Okay. Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio by Jessica Abel. That's what we've been talking about, folks. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back to talk more with Jessica Abel on Living Writers.
Band 2.
This is where you have to make it.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Jessica Abel joins us from Philadelphia. Books on the table with us, Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio, and Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. Jessica, thanks for choosing the songs for today's program. So good. Welcome. Really good. Just what I needed. And
you want me to read from Growing Gills now?
Oh, yeah. Well,
we
you know what?
That part.
Well, don't worry. We are not. It's true. We did start. Don't worry. I won't let us not do that. I promise. But just a couple of things, just connecting to what we were just talking about. And then let's move to Growing Gills. Go back. So you mentioned, like, for interviewing, you would follow your curiosity. Like, that's what you would do. Like, you would trust that. And how you framed it earlier was a little bit like, well, because I didn't know what to do for, like, how to do, for example, what Ira Glass would do. But it occurred to me as I heard that, it almost feels like, is that, I don't know, I okay, maybe it's because I'm talking to you, Jessica, and I'm trying to butter you up. No, I'm just kidding. But I love that you're like ready to see what happens, and you've got like this idea, and then you and it's a risk. It's like you're gonna try to discover something, and in the listening, when you actually ask someone something, see what happens. Instead of trying the other way, almost sounds somewhat controlling, and it might be limiting.
Yes. I mean, I hear you. And we talked about that. Like, that's people, you know, Ira was talking about a young Ira.
Oh, right.
Resisting this exact idea and saying, like, this is, you know, I'm just going to discover the story as it is in the world. And you can do that, but it's just a much less, you're going to end up without the tape you want. You know what I mean? And you're going to end up missing stuff that you need. And I had a book timeline and an ability to go back and get more stuff out of it. And I should say, in clarification, that I think Ira and Robert Smith and everybody else who's a great interviewer, and they follow their curiosity for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
If somebody says something unexpected, they are on it. You know, and they're like, let's go, let's do this. I don't care what I was planning. We're going this way.
Yeah.
So I think that's absolutely true about great interviews in general, is that your curiosity and your ability to be present and have a real conversation in the moment is what makes or breaks it.
Yeah.
But I think that in addition to some planning and thinking like, I'm going to need these parts, is pretty wise.
Yeah. Having some understanding of what you think something could be.
Mm-hmm.
So real quickly then, when you talked about your rough logs, and what is that like when you're transcribing, like how do you do it? Like, do you have any, I don't know, best practices? Do you use a specific tool or application, or are you handwriting, or yeah, how do you do it?
Well, I don't anymore, but at the time I would I never handwrite stuff if I can help it, because it's just then I just have to transcribe it again, and typing is faster. So the idea with making logs is that you're listening at real speed and you are summing up phrases and ideas rather than trying to transcribe. You're not actually transcribing anything. You're writing down chunks of information.
Mm.
And it's one of the first things they test people on who start working for NPR or This American Life, and can you log tape? And these days, I think almost everything gets transcribed, you know, by services and digitally and whatever, and like maybe there's less logging going on in radio, I don't know.
Right.
But for me now, I use a, you know, machine translation service, which is, I found a new one that's pretty damn good. Like, it's close. And if I need something for print, I will go back and listen to the part and get it right, you know, and like get the transcription exactly right. And then I'll edit it, because it's print. I don't have to have that audio. I'll take all the likes and you knows out and all that stuff. especially if it's me talking, it gets cleaned up. but if I don't need that, if I just need the, I need to remember what got said and spark new ideas, then I don't clean it all up. It's, you know, and it's longer than a log. It's, in some ways, logs are better because logs are a representation of you thinking it through as you go, taking notes on a piece rather, or on a tape rather than transcribing. And when you're reading transcription, you get really down in the weeds about some way some turn of phrase happened and then it's not quite right in the transcription, and you got to find it and fix it. I mean, it can get really tedious. But for sure, that's what I would have done if I had those tools at that time in 2013 or whatever when I was doing all this.
Because this makes me think of what you were talking about earlier, Jessica, with when you're creating your podcasts and how you're scripting it, but so it sounds, but you're maybe generating it through talking or performing it and then going and then transcribing it. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding your part of the process there because it was so interesting.
Well, it's not quite that. I mean, I am writing it first, but then if I'm saying it out loud and it doesn't work,
right,
then I'll change it. And I think some of it comes from, you know, my comics ever since I was in my, you know, mid-20s have been primarily dialogue driven. There's not a lot of narration.
So you've got a really good ear.
Yeah, I've developed, you know, an ear for dialogue and thinking about the way people say things. And I always have had a real interest in the way people say things in terms of phrase and how that can be meaningful. Like as a writer, I'm just really interested in the particular ways people express themselves. And I think that, you know, plays out in my prose writing as well.
So let's hear some of that prose writing from Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life.
Okay, this is chapter 2, Drowning in Idea Debt. How and why we hold on to too many creative ideas and how that can stop you from finishing any of them. You're a creative person. By definition, that means you've got a big imagination. Whether you're someone who has a couple of huge ideas that obsess you for years, or whether you're constantly coming up with new, potentially awesome stuff, or even if you're someone who lets ideas come and go, not believing that any of them are good enough to merit notice, you know better than anyone that the only way you will actually cause those ideas to become real in the world is to focus like a laser and do the daily, weekly, and ongoing work to build them. And that's where you stop. There's a massive gap between knowing that's how the project comes into being and actually doing that work. Do you lie awake sometimes thinking about what might go into your project, what the characters or environment might look like, or how it will touch the audience in a whole new way? Do you imagine what it will feel like to have this project under your belt and what kind of effect it will have on your life? Let me tell you about Forest Lords. Forest Lords is a series of 10 fantasy novels, each a 1,000-page brick, about the epic adventures of Greenleaf Barksley, elf proletarian, and his journeys to receive the golden leaf and save his homeland from the scourge of the curse of the Titanus Denox. The thing is, none of this series exists. Not even Forest Lords Volume 1, The Elven Soul. There are binders and binders of lore. There are sketchbooks full of character designs that look suspiciously similar to ElfQuest characters. There's the vivid, lively picture the putative author has in his head of how it's going to feel to write a fantasy series that has everyone panting for the next book or movie or TV show. But there is no book. There's only idea debt. What's idea debt? Idea debt describes a phase of the creative process where many people get stuck, sometimes permanently. It's what happens when you spend a ton of time picturing what a project is going to look like and how awesome it's going to be to have this thing done in the world and how cool it and therefore you will look and how in demand you'll be, and how much money you're going to make, and very little time actually making the thing. I understand this concept all too intimately, but I didn't have a name for it until Kazuo Kibuishi, the author of the comic series Amulet, introduced me to the term idea debt when I interviewed him for my podcast, Out on the Wire, Episode 7, The Dark Forest. This is Kazuo Kibuishi. You have this dream, this idea, this awesome thing for years. You think, oh, I'm going to do this epic adventure, and it's going to be so great. And the truth is, no matter what you do, it will never be as great as it is in your mind. So you're really setting yourself up for failure in some way. And I try to avoid that as much as possible. even though I have to be the architect of this sprawling epic adventure, I don't want to think of it that way. If I do, I'm probably going to ruin it. I used to go snowboarding in the winter. I used to like hitting all the jumps. And when I would go down the mountain, I would notice a bunch of young snowboarders who were waiting at the top of the jumps. They may look like they're waiting to turn, but in fact, they're waiting there because they're actually kind of afraid to hit that jump. And what they don't realize is that over time, they're getting colder. They're physically getting colder. The idea debt of having to make that jump and land it and be impressive is getting greater. And so by the time they actually do it, they're not going to fulfill that dream. So the one thing I learned is just hit the jump or pass it. Just do it in the moment or not at all. And so you can move on and wait for the next time. I try not to look at the thing I'm going to do as being this amazing, great, grand thing, because if I do that, I'll probably not achieve what I'm trying to do. It'll be like looking at the sun.
Thanks, Jessica. So just take the jump.
Or skip it.
Or skip it.
Okay. No, I mean, for real, like,
yeah,
hit the jump or skip it. Like, those are the choices. Don't stand there looking at it and thinking about it and dreaming about it and writing notes about it and talking about it. Don't. Just don't do that.
So everyone out there, see what I mean? Jessica Abel's voice is going to stay in your head, and this is a good thing. This is a good thing. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back for more with Jessica Abel, Growing Gills, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back.
Para hacerte un collar, los hallé una mañana en la bruma cuando caminaba junto al inmenso mar.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, just in time, today on the program, Jessica Abel joins us via phone from Philadelphia. We just heard part of Growing Gills from Chapter 2, I believe, How to Find Creative Focus When You're Drowning in Your Daily Life, thinking about idea debt. Jessica, like, you don't shy away, like, in these early pages, too, about really running head on into things that are kind of tough to talk about. Even look, I mean, case in point, here I am kind of stammering through it. But things like self-doubt, anxiety, procrastination, this is what Growing Gills kind of takes a run at right from the start.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm a very, unwoo, you know, like, not just very straightforward person, you know. I think that not talking about this stuff is not particularly useful. And, you know, whenever I've been in a room full of other creative people, it's what we talk about. You know, we talk about the ways, it's rare to be in a room with a bunch of people who are like, you know, humble bragging their way through the day. It's mostly like, how do you do this? How is this? I don't understand. Like, why is this so hard? I don't get it. You know, and that's, you know, a lot of that is what I'm trying to tap into here.
To help people, like, you're very clear.
Help people have that conversation and feel like they're not weird. Like, there's nothing weird about this stuff. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with, you know, as a coach, and they're thinking, they think that there's something the matter with them because they find it difficult to, you know, commit to creative work that, you know, is verifiably, like, the thing, that's what they want to be doing. They feel really, really strongly that this is what they want from their lives, and yet they have a really hard time actually making it happen, and they think something, I'm broken, something's the matter. And it's just the most normal thing in the world to feel that way. And I think that alone is really liberating for people. You know, when people read, you know, I was running a workshop a week or so ago, live, and I read the what I call story matrix, which is it's a storytelling framework that I developed based on work from Out on the Wire. And in fact, I'm going to be teaching that in an online workshop a week from Sunday. That's, if anybody's interested in that, they should get in touch with me right away because it's filling up. But that's going to be really fun. But anyway, I was doing this thing, and so I was reading the story matrix that I wrote to write Growing Gills. It's a story structure that sort of lays out all of the points and all the escalation, all of the, you know, it creates a whole spine for the book. And I was skimming through it a little bit because it's kind of long, but reading off my paper and just, you know, read. I'm going to skip this part. Okay, blah, blah, blah. And I look, it's silent. I look up, and everybody in the room is like staring at me. They're just like mouth open. And somebody's like, how did you get in my head? Like, how did you do that? This, that's me, you know? And I'm thinking, I mean, I know it. I know it's true because people told me that before, but I'm not usually in a room with them when they tell me that. And it's just very palpable. It was like, oh my God, that's exactly it. And one of the things I am most proud of and happy with is when I can release people from that feeling of like, this is, it's just me, I'm weird, I'm messed up, it's my fault. And start taking action to do things differently. You know?
Yeah. And this is definitely a passion of yours. Like, you can hear it, Jessica.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so how long have, and this started with a creative focus workshop, right? Or was it, well, you were in the classroom already.
Yeah.
Well, cause you were in the classroom and you're still in the classroom in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. But this seems like it's also for a broader audience. It's people who are out there in their lives that might be struggling because of this creative compulsion and feeling alone in it.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have taught this, elements of this, to undergrads for years, but I wasn't thinking of it as like, this is what I'm supposed to be teaching them until recently, since I've written the book, since I've been doing this group coaching, you know, stuff and all that stuff, I've incorporated into my, you know, intentionally into my classroom. So I teach a lot of this stuff to undergrads in my classes, which I think is, I'm really glad I am, but it's really interesting to me how unready a lot of them are for it because they still feel totally invincible and like, this isn't going to apply to me. So the people I tend to work with, you know, are usually mid-30s to mid-50s and have been trying to make it work on their own for a while and figuring out, oh, I actually could use some help with this. That would be nice to not feel totally on my own here. And that's when I end up working with people. It's rare that I work with somebody in their, certainly not in their early 20s, because they're just not ready for it. They're not ready to admit, you know, be vulnerable with other people and say, I feel like something's the matter.
And so, Jessica, with these, like the creative focus workshops, how do people get in touch with you? Because you mentioned better get in touch with me. Would it be through your website to sign up for the workshop?
Oh yeah, no. If anybody's interested in that story matrix thing, that's not Growing Gills material. That's Out on the Wire material. But that is something I'm doing in a week and a half. And yeah, just send me an email through my website, and I'd be happy to send you the information. But in terms of the Creative Focus workshop, that is, I offer that in like timed cohorts. You know, I've been doing it twice a year. I'm not sure if I'm going to offer it again this year. You know, I'm not sure. But what I do is individual coaching more, like, these days. That's what I'm doing a little bit more of, is working one-on-one with people.
And I wonder what, like, that'll be the differences, or maybe you've already seen some, from having the group that's working together versus you working one-on-one with the individual.
I mean, it is really different. It has a very different feel. I love working in a group. I think it's really super effective. You know, it's sometimes hard to, you know, there's different people are working on different things. But I think that everybody can, people can contribute more than they understand to other people's progress.
Right.
You know, a lot of times they feel like, who am I to say this stuff? But like I said, you know, half the battle is realizing you're not alone and you're not weird. And having a bunch of other people doing the same thing is a good way to realize that.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. The evidence right. surrounds you.
Exactly. And they're like, oh my God, it's everybody's doing it. I'm like, I told you. I'm not lying. So the group is really powerful, but I also, what's really great about working one-on-one with people is that I can really tailor what I'm doing to what they need. And so with my one-on-one clients, I go through a lot of the same material, but I do it in a much more customized and handheld kind of way. And, you know, working with people who are often creative professionals already, but their time all gets sucked up by client work and they can't figure out how to do the work they really love and want to be doing, you know, or people who run creative businesses and, again, client work and emails and stuff just kind of overwhelming and burnout and needing to create, you know, to really build out space for strategic work and moving forward on larger projects that are, you know, really the legacy building, future building stuff that you want to be doing. That's what I like to help people with.
And that it sounds like that's what's, you know, engaging you right now. It's like this is what is capturing your attention. And are these the stories that you're going to be telling next, do you think, with some of your projects?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I am... I'm not writing anything right now. Part of my mission is to not like overburden myself with too many projects. Like
that's,
I always have.
You that's
know, trying
in the
to learn
book.
My own lessons.
Yep. That's in the book.
Yeah. But I am moving toward an idea of a new book, another prose book that would be, it's very much in the same vein as Growing Gills, but maybe less workbooky. But about this idea of scarcity and, the scarcity mindset, which comes from feeling like you have no time, you have no money, and so you have to just like get into action and act, you know, do whatever's right in front of you, and this kind of super limited perspective that you can get into, tunnel vision mode, where you're making decisions that cause more problems in the future, make it impossible for you to do and be who you want to be in the future because you're making scarcity-based decisions in today. And essentially what you end up with is burnout. You end up with a situation where every second of every day is optimized to fill with the most possible stuff, and the stuff is not the stuff that you really care about.
Jessica, it's clear to me that I think we need to talk again. and definitely about these ideas that are brewing and marinating, and also already have their roots in Growing Gills, what we've been talking about today, but also about your comics, your graphic novel. If you're game, I would love to talk with you again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to. That'd be great.
And really quickly, I think, is this right that your husband, Matt Madden, he's got some WCBN connections from the 90s?
Absolutely. Yeah. He used to be a DJ there, and he went to U of M and graduated as an undergrad there. And he was a CBN regular.
Greg told me that when I sent out the email that you were going to be on the program today. So hello.
He might be listening right now. Hi, Matt.
Shout out to Matt from all your pals at WCBN FM. You can never quite get away, right, Jessica? we'll always be there. But thanks so much for talking today. I've so enjoyed it. And and I look forward to our next conversation today on Living Writers. Jessica Abel, we've been talking about Growing Gills, how to find creative focus when you're drowning in your daily life, and also Out on the Wire, the storytelling secrets of the new masters of radio. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks to Steph and to Gina for engineering. Thanks to Frank Uli for post-production. Big thanks to Jessica Abel for talking today. Until next time.
Oh, what's he gonna do? wanna get down? Tell me, what you gonna do? Do you wanna get down? What you gonna do? You wanna get down? What you gonna do? You wanna get down?